Well, good afternoon. I'm here on behalf of Mr. Torres, who's right here, the author of the book, and his co-author, Ruben Uriarte, who couldn't make it. And unfortunately, I've been very sick, and my voice is not doing so well today. So I'm going to actually pass the torch to our author, Mr. Torres, who's the author of this story. And he's going to continue, because I don't think I could stand up here and talk for an hour without losing my voice. So I'm going to have Mr. Torres go from here.
Okay. Okay. It's one of life's ironies. Steve was telling me that he hasn't been sick in like 2 years. And then yesterday in the morning, he woke up and with a tickle in his throat, and it progressed very quickly. So he had been preparing for this presentation. He helped me with the research on this book, and we worked together, as the introduction pointed out. We worked together on doing this, telling this story at various events. So I'm sad, Steve, that you did all that work and weren't able to present today, but I will share the things that Steve was going to tell you, and also give you a little bit of my research, my own personal outlook on this. I'm going to be talking about a fascinating encounter from the 1960s that UFO researchers commonly referred to as the Cisco Grove UFO encounter. And this is a fascinating case that I had never heard about. And actually, my co-author of the book Aliens in the Forest, Mr. Ruben J. Uriarte, is from Northern California. He lives in the Oakland area, in Union City, suburb of the, or a small city there in near the Bay Area, in the Bay Area. So anyway, Ruben has been involved in UFO research for over 30 years in California. And many years ago, he came across this file that contained a lot of information. The research that had been done on this case was very extensive. It had correspondence. It had letters from the Air Force talking about the case, the evidence that was found at the scene, the testimony that was taken by the Air Force investigators, had photographs of the site where it occurred, the eyewitness testimonies. One of the objects that was seen was 150 feet wide, in length, rather. And there were two witnesses that saw that craft. But the story itself is much more advanced than just a sighting, as you're about to find out. But anyway, Ruben, who was, he had just taken a position with MUFON, Mutual UFO Network of Northern California, and he was looking at some of the old files from UFO research that was done in the 60s. And he ran across this interesting accordion file, which he later mailed to me when we decided to do a book about it. It's such a rich case for which there was so much research and investigation done into it, and nobody had ever done anything with it. It was not out there in the public. And one of the main reasons it was not in the public, as I'll explain as the presentation goes on, is because the principal eyewitness, Mr. Donald Shrum, who still lives today, by the way, now lives in Missouri, he was working for the U.S. government indirectly through one of its missile defense contractors at the time that this incident happened in 1964. So he felt that if he came forward with his name in relation to what he saw and what he experienced in this case, that there was a strong possibility he would have lost his employment with Aerojet Corporation, which was the nation's leading provider of missiles and rockets back in the early 60s. So Mr. Donald Shrum was working for Aerojet at the time. And so that's the main reason that this mysterious file that my friend Ruben ran across many years later had never really been made public. So what Ruben did was he contacted the gentleman who was the main witness, Mr. Shrum, and told him, you know, this is a fascinating case. I'd like to talk to you about it. So he went and visited with Mr. Shrum, who at that time still lived in the Sacramento, California area. And he carried out this extensive interview with Mr. Shrum, and you're going to see parts of the video clip of that interview here in a little bit. And it's a fascinating story. So that's the reason that it really hasn't been publicized until our book came out last year. It really had, many people had never heard about it, and it's a fascinating case. So I'm going to set the stage first by telling you that this took place in September of 1964, and it's a small town east of Sacramento, near the border with Nevada, called Cisco Grove, as you see on the map there. Right here along the, actually, you know, nearest to Reno, Nevada. So it's right on the border. And right in here, this green stuff is the Tahoe National Forest, which is a large forested area in Northern California. And one of the things you're going to miss is my friend Steve, who is going to give this presentation today along with my assistants, has actually been, Steve, you've been out to the Tahoe National Forest. It's a very rocky and hilly and very rough terrain even today. And even it was even less developed back in 1964 when this incident happened. So now, if you look on this map, there's really only one road, this little windy road that you see here at the top. There's really only one road here. And actually, what I was pointing at originally was a railroad, but up here is the major road, which connects Sacramento with Reno. But down in here, trying to get to this area is extremely difficult, and it requires some serious hiking and serious preparation. So Mr. Shrum and his fellow hunters had set up a camp right here where you see this arrow, the camp. And then they had gone down into the woods. This was before rifle season had started in this area of California. And so they were hunting with bows and arrows. And they had been out bow and arrow hunting before, but not in this area. So they were out, he and two companions, two buddies of him, his from work, who worked for Aerojet Corporation of Sacramento, had gone out in the woods bow and arrow hunting when this incident happened. And where Mr. Shrum, down at the bottom of this screen that you're looking at, where it's labeled UFO, where Mr. Shrum had his UFO encounter was right down here, which is a distance of a couple of miles from where they had originally set the base camp up, about a mile and a half to 2 miles. And then one of the other hunters, Mr. Alvarez, was standing somewhere in this area when he saw the UFO coming out down out of the Earth's atmosphere. Because the three men had separated out during the evening's hunt, all three of them had gone more or less separate directions. Because of that, he wasn't aware that Mr. Shrum had an up-close and personal encounter with the UFO and the beings in it that occurred afterward. But when Mr. Alvarez saw the UFO, he was standing, you know, between the camp and the site where Mr. Shrum was, and he saw that object coming down out of the sky. He later gave written testimony to the investigators in the case. The lead investigator was Mr. Paul Cerny of the NICAP, National Investigations Committee for Aerial Phenomenon, very active group in the 1960s, 50s and 60s, investigating UFOs. And those files from NICAP, resulted in hundreds of pages of investigation, eyewitness testimony, which were later ended up in the possession of my co-author, Ruben Uriarte, who was a close friend of Mr. Paul Cerny, the original investigator. This is what Mr. Shrum looked like at the time that this incident happened. In this picture, he was 26 years old at the time of the UFO incident, and as I've mentioned, he was employed by Aerojet. And Stan Friedman actually did consulting work for Aerojet in the design and in engineering missiles. So when we were first telling Stan this story, he understood exactly what was going on at that time frame, 1964. Aerojet Corporation was one of the leading missile defense contractors, and so that's who Mr. Shrum worked for. This was a map or a sketch that was done by Mr. Shrum. Up here in the top part of the map is the base camp that the group had established, the three hunters. Then they had kind of wandered down and eventually separated themselves out into, they each went individual directions. And Mr. Shrum ended up down here where he had his up-close and personal UFO encounter that we're going to talk about. Okay, so as the evening went on, this was a long weekend. They had a 3-day weekend. They had Friday, Saturday, and Sunday off from work. So they went early on Friday to the Tahoe National Forest, and they went out with their bow and arrows, and there wasn't much happening in the way of hunting. Mr. Shrum told me that they had shot at a couple of small animals, I think he said a snake, but there wasn't much in the way of deer or anything that they really were intending to. So as the evening wore on, the three men had become separated from each other, and they had a kind of a code that they went by when they were hunting, and when it got to be dark, and if they were separated from each other, they would each try to find a place that was safe from predators. You know, there were bear in this area that had attacked campers before, and so they were each wanting to find a place to hold out for the night. If they could find a rocky place, maybe with boulders surrounding or something like that. And Mr. Shrum, in this particular case, decided he was going to use a tree for shelter, which is not, it's really not an uncommon thing. And we're going to listen to the first video clip here, Mr. Shrum. I'm going to warn you that the sound system here in the auditorium has a little bit of a hum on these video clips, and I apologize. We'll see. I'm going to disconnect. In between showing you the video clips, I'm going to disconnect that sound because it's kind of distracting. Here's Mr. Shrum explaining why he chose the place that he chose to spend the night.
Well, we're getting ready for the evening hunt, and I went down the one ridge, and this one friend of mine went down the canyon bottom, and the other went down the other ridge, and when we got to the end of the ridge, it was just a sheer drop-off where I was, so I had to backtrack and go down and around the other side of the ridge. And by the time I got to the bottom, it was pitch black. And so I stumbled through the brush. I couldn't see nothing. It was just dark. Before the moon comes up, it gets really dark in the mountains. And I crashed through the brush and stuff, and then I could see the moon was starting up, and I saw a big granite cliff with a crack that went up the side, and the crack was about a foot wide, so I was able to walk up there And it was a tree right at the edge when I got up there. So I figured there's a lot of bear in the area, so I figured I'd spend the night in the tree. The base of the tree to the first limb was about 12 feet. But from the rock, it was only about 7 feet. I could reach up and hand walk out to the trunk of the tree and then pull myself up and anyway, there was two limbs come out on an angle, and then there was one that I sit on, and then I put my foot on the other one. And so I was figuring on spending the night up there.
How far away was the tree to the campsite, approximately, would you estimate?
It was probably close to a mile, maybe three quarters.
So your campsite wasn't really that far away then?
No, uh-uh.
Because of the terrain?
Yeah, I was over a mountain from that, you know, so I couldn't see the campfire.
Okay, one key thing there is that Mr. Shrum, decided he had a military style belt, and he was planning to strap himself, you know, up in the tree, put that strap around one of the larger limbs, and just, you know, spend the night there. One of the things that worried him is there had been campers and hikers who had been, approached closely by bears and attacked in some instances. So what happened next is where the whole episode begins. Mr. Shrum was sitting there around that tree, and as you can see in this map, he was down here in this area, and all of a sudden there was a strange light that came toward him, or actually it was kind of moving right to left, in his field of vision, off at a distance. And at first he said it looked like there was somebody walking up on top of one of the ridges with a lantern, holding a lantern. And so it was swaying a little bit, but went moving across his field of vision from left to right, kind of parallel with the horizon. And he thought, you know, at first it was really strange, this little light. And then it made this turn, as you can see here, it made a turn toward his tree, the tree where he was standing at. And he began to think it was very odd. Now, his first thought was he had become separated from his two hunting buddies. Perhaps they had contacted the park rangers, the National Park Service, and somebody had sent a helicopter out to find them. So that was his first thought, as we're going to hear in this video clip.
And then I saw a light. It looked like a lantern going up and down a trail. But then it came over the top of the tree, and I got kind of excited then because I thought it was a helicopter from the Forest Service. And I stood between two of the fires that I built on the rocks and waved my arms and yelled and screamed and finally that light started coming towards me. So I was really relieved then because I thought it was a helicopter still, until it got within maybe 60 feet or yards, I'm not sure the distance at night, but it just stood, hovered there with no sound. So then I panicked because I knew it was no helicopter. I thought it was something from outer space, but it looked like
Well, for some reason that video stopped a little short, but what he says next is he saw this object, and you'll see there in the lower part of your screen, at first, all he could really see, these three panels that you see in the middle, these rectangular panels, had not opened up yet, so this was dark when he first saw it. The whole shape of it was generally cylindrical or oval, elongated oval. But at first, what really drew his attention was a very bright light at the front end of the craft. This small light, he described it as a small white light or a headlight, was shining very brightly, and at first he thought that that was the entire object, that that one little point of light composed or comprised the entire object. But later, as it came closer to his field of view, he could tell that there was a massive dark hull, and that the point of light was just a little headlight or front part to the craft. And then a little bit later, the three windows or portals, as he calls them, opened up in the middle of the hull. And the color was generally kind of dark, grayish, metallic for the hull. And once again, when he first spotted this thing, it was kind of drifting left to or right to left across his field of vision in the distance. And so he built these fires, thinking small fires at the base of his tree on some rocks, thinking that this was a helicopter that had been sent by his friends who reported him being lost. So shortly after or concurrent with the building of those fires, this object then turned, did close to a 90-degree angle turn, and started heading toward him. And that was when he said that he realized that this was not a helicopter. This is based on a sketch by the eyewitness, Mr. Shrum. You can see right here in a lot more detail, you got the small white light, which the witness saw first. He called it a headlight. And then there was this dark object, which really, he couldn't really tell the shape of it until the three cylindrical panels or windows opened up later in the sighting. And as we're going to hear in a little bit, something very unusual came streaking out of the center panel, is the next thing that he observes. Here's a drawing that was done by a gentleman named Neil Reby, who did the artwork for our book. And using the description that Mr. Shrum gave us, this is Mr. Shrum sitting in the tree. He's wearing camouflage gear and a military-style belt with canteen. And he's seeing this huge object hover almost parallel to his line of sight, maybe a little bit higher. And at first it was all dark, and then later these three center panels opened up. And this is a close-up of the map of the area. You've got the small town of Cisco Grove, California, up here. You've got Loch Laven Lakes here in this area. Near the lakes, they had set up their camp, and then they had gone about a mile or so. Mr. Shrum had gone down here to this tree, and then they saw the ship. He saw the ship coming this way, and one of the other hunters also saw the ship when it made its initial entry. And as I mentioned, Mr. Shrum saw something very unusual next as well, and that is the appearance of a second ship, a smaller ship, that came out of the middle panel.
And then I saw three panels of light, like windows or whatever, and I saw a flash come from the bottom of the center one, and just saw a dark object go down to in the canyon, and then I lost track of it. And then the next thing I saw was a little blinking light up on the top of originally where the first one came from.
This object that you first saw that left the center panel. What did it look like, Don?
Well, at that time, all I saw was a flash and saw a dark object go down.
Dark object, kind of
Well, I couldn't really say. It went so fast. But then I saw when it landed up on the ridge that it, I could see like a half, I could only see part of the top, but it had a little light on it and looked like the top of a flying saucer that I'd seen in pictures.
Like a dome?
Or? Yes. Yeah, like a dome. And then I kept my eyes on that.
Okay, so he saw the smaller ship coming out of the larger ship. He calls a larger ship the mothership, and he calls a smaller ship the scout ship. This is very interesting because, as we heard Stanton Friedman talk about earlier, it makes sense, and there have been numerous sightings of these very large craft, sometimes a mile or longer in length, and out of which smaller ships come. It's kind of a recurring observation that witnesses have made over the years in UFO cases. So this certainly goes along with that. And now this is interesting here. Mr. Shrum is once again down here by this tree and hovering over this canyon, hovering near him at nearly eye level, is this huge ship, which is represented here by the three panels and the small light in the front end. And out of the center panel comes a smaller ship, which zooms over here. And then what happens next is really remarkable. There was a strange appearance of these humanoid figures, which Mr. Shrum is going to talk about in this next video.
And I heard some thrashing through the brush in probably 5-10 minutes. These two humanoids come out of the brush, and they kind of broke some of the brush off and was looking at it. Then they came straight underneath the tree and looked up at me. And I knew right then I was fingered.
They found you.
Yeah, they found me.
Can you describe them for us?
Yeah, they looked like 4 or 5 feet. Of course, I'm looking down at them, so they'd be shorter than they probably are. And they had a silvery, like a one-piece suit on, and it seemed like it had the joints, puffy joints, you know, on the shoulders and the elbows, and the legs I didn't see that clear.
The humanoids, were you able to see their faces?
No, it was just a kind of a dark shadow. I could see the two like eyes that were, looked like welding goggles to me. They were the same as welding goggles. And then the rest of the face was kind of a blur. I couldn't see looking down at them.
You're able to see them was it large or small? They're
about 2 inches in diameter. It reminded me, just like I said, like a welding goggle.
By the way, the person you hear asking the questions is my co-author, Ruben Uriarte, who did this interview and arranged for Mr. Shrum to go on camera and tell his story. And so he saw these strange figures with the, what looked like, they were wearing welder's goggles, and they had these strange uniforms on. But the story gets even weirder because shortly after the arrival of these humanoid figures, there was another object which Mr. Shrum thinks may have been the same type of humanoid, except wearing a bulkier suit, or perhaps it was some kind of a mechanical, creature. He referred to it as being more robotic. So this second type of creature arrived on the scene a few minutes later, as we're going to hear in this description.
And then I saw two flashing red orange light eyes coming, just picking his way down the ridge, just between the rocks and around them and everything, and come down and was on this big boulder, big flat rock. And then he kind of looked up at me, and he moved his hand through the fire cinders and kind of scattered them.
And the eyes of this other creature, like the robot, what did that look like to you?
And it had kind of like fire. Kind of a orangish, reddish orange, or yellowish orange, and it kind of flickered like fire. And they're about the same diameter as about 2 inches in diameter as the humanoids.
Okay, so this second creature or entity that appeared, unlike the first one, which seemed to be Mr. Shrum's preliminary impression of the humanoid figures, were they weren't any threat to him. That was the impression that he got. But the second figure seemed more menacing, more threatening. There was just something about them, the way they approached the tree in which Mr. Shrum was located and so forth, that seemed menacing to him. And what happened next is rather amazing. This second being, this mechanical-looking man, came to the base of the tree in which Mr. Shrum was. Then it, using one of its hands, it touched the bottom part of its head, and a white vapor, suddenly came out of its head and up into the tree, causing Mr. Shrum to go unconscious for a short while, as we hear in this next segment.
Then he come down up on the rock. He was about 7 feet from me. And then he touched his mouth, and kind of a steam vapor come out of his mouth, and it lit up his face so I could see some detail. And then I blacked out when that steam hit me, or I guess it was. It was kind of took the air from me, and I'd gasp for air and then black out, and I fell over my bow, and that's the only thing that kept me in the tree. And then, so I figured they were out to get me then.
So, you know, the research that has been done into this case suggests that what Mr. Shrum was exposed to was some type of asphyxiant, a substance that draws all the oxygen out of the air. And essentially, if you are exposed to an asphyxiant for a long period of time, you will die of suffocation. However, because you know he got it in short blasts, he would black out for a short period of time and then come to again. So, essentially, throughout this encounter, this evening's encounter, which lasted approximately 12 hours all night long, Mr. Shrum was repeatedly getting blasted by this vapor and knocked unconscious throughout the night. So he decided that he was going to fight, and the only weapons that he had at his disposal was his bow. He had a very large wooden recurve bow that was capable of firing an arrow at a very high velocity, equal to a shot from a rifle, and he had 3 arrows remaining. So this is his description of what happens next.
So I had a 60-pound bow, which is a very high velocity, and I shot. Seeing how the robot's the only thing that was causing me harm, I shot the chest area, and it has the velocity of a rifle at that distance, because I'm only about 7-8 feet from him. And it, when I hit the chest, the sparks would fly like electrical, like an arc welder, kind of. And then that robot backed up and almost knocked him down. He kind of fell back against the rock. And the two at the bottom took off and headed for the brush and stood out there about 30 feet from me. And then I shot two more arrows, and it was about the same time sequence that these two humanoids would, every time I'd shoot, they'd go back up into the brush, just almost out of sight from me.
Mr. Shrum, once again, the only weapon he had at his disposal was the bow and arrows. He used the three arrows. It had some effect on the creature, but it didn't have much. It would cause him to stumble backward a little bit. I think you can tell from listening to the witness that he's a very down-to-earth, no-nonsense sort of guy. In fact, people that we've talked to who know him say that he's a man of few words. You know, he doesn't, prior to his experience, he really wasn't interested in UFOs. He had heard about them because they had been in the news quite a bit in the early 1960s. But he was not one who sought publicity of any kind or really wanted to get involved in anything like this. In fact, his name was, although he gave eyewitness testimony, and it was released in the 1960s, not in great detail, but just his story was told in a general way. His name was never given in connection with what happened. He was always listed as an anonymous source. Once again, because of his connection as an employee of a government contractor, he didn't want that sort of publicity, which could impact his job. So, until recently, Mr. Shrum now is in his late 70s. He's in very poor health. And he contacted my co-author, Ruben Uriarte, and asked if we would be interested in putting it in a book form, his story. He wants his story told. And this happens a lot in the field of UFO research. People who have an experience like this hold on to it and keep it within themselves, keep it within their immediate circle for many years. But then as it gets near the end of their lives and they're kind of reassessing things and thinking about, you know, what has happened in their lives and things that are unresolved, a lot of times, especially with people who have served in the military in secret capacities, have seen things, they'll wait until near the end of their lives before disclosing. And so that's what has happened with Mr. Shrum. But the story gets even weirder. And by the way, here's Mr. Shrum, a picture that my co-author Ruben Uriarte took a few years back with the actual wooden recurve bow that he had with him on that night in that dark forest in Northern California. Mr. Shrum was now out of ammunition. He was out of weapons, and he had to think fast. Being an outdoorsman, a sportsman, with a lot of years of experience hunting, he was a quick thinker and was trying to find a way to survive, to hold these creatures at bay. And what came into his mind was to set things on fire and throw them down at them. Maybe he could start a fire down at the base of the tree. So he was wanting to do that.
Then I ran out of arrows, so I only had three left. And I thought, well, that's when pomade hair It was just, I mean, the cap I had on was just soaked with oil.
For your hair.
Yeah, from my hair, yeah, pomade. And I always carried all kinds of books and matches with me when I hunted. And so I lit that cap, and it just blazed up, and I dropped it down the base of the tree. And just in that instant, they moved back about 12, 15 feet. And I glanced over at the ship that was over the canyon, kind of almost level with me. And it was almost out of sight. It was just like a star. It moved that fast, just in that second. So then I got the idea that they're scared of fire. So I burned everything but my T-shirt and my jeans. And come to find out later on that it was 32 degrees out, and I was shaking and kind of overexposed for the weather. And I had a bunch of change, and I threw it down, and they all kind of gathered around it. Well, after I shot my or started burning stuff and throwing it down, and I even tied some of my shirt that I ripped up to a compass so I could try to hit some brush, because there wasn't nothing right underneath the tree. And then I caught a little pile of brush on fire. I figured that would bring the cavalry. But when I run out of stuff to burn, I headed for the top of the tree. And then it was a pretty sparse tree. I could see down to the ground. And I broke off the top and threw it down. And anytime I throw down or shake the tree, these humanoids would back up.
Okay, so he's up here in this tree, and as you can probably, I mean, it's very clear that he's doing everything in his power to survive this ordeal. He is, he's using his wits. He's using his hunter instincts. The thing is, you know, this case has been referred to as Don Shrum's personal war of the worlds. He was locked in combat with these beings. It was very obvious that they were trying to get to him. In fact, in between knocking him out with this strange vapor, this asphyxiant, in between those attempts, the humanoid figures would attempt to climb the tree. And sometimes they'd get as close to where they were touching his feet, and then he would kick at them and shake the tree and do everything in his power to discourage them from climbing up higher. So he was doing everything in his power to survive this evening. And this went on for hours, as I previously mentioned. The creatures were trying to climb. And one interesting thing is that he heard sounds. He says he interpreted them as being signals among the creatures, and also between the ship, which was hovering nearby, and these creatures. He heard sounds. It could have been mistaken for bird song, for owls, but what came to his mind was that these creatures were communicating with each other. And every time there would be these sounds, then the creatures would change their behavior. For example, there would be a sound, and then the humanoids would immediately attempt to climb the tree. And then there would be another sound, and the climbing would stop, and the robot would close in and dispel some more gas. So he got the distinct impression that the sounds he was hearing were not nature sounds, that they were communications going on. And what's interesting is he was very traumatized by this experience, as you can imagine, and he actually suffered the symptoms of post-traumatic stress syndrome afterward. He spent many years trying to recuperate from the experience that he underwent this evening, this particular evening. And whenever he was out in outdoors with his family camping or whatever, and he would hear certain sounds in the forest at night, it would bring it all back to him, and he would tense up and, you know, start hyperventilating and start behaving like a frightened individual. So this really, really impacted him for the rest of his life. By the way, what you're looking at on the screen is an actual drawing done by Mr. Shrum, the large picture on the right side of the screen. That's an actual drawing that Mr. Shrum did of himself up in the tree, the large mothership hovering nearby, the two humanoids here, and over here behind the rock, partially concealed by this rock, is this robot or robotic creature.
Drasko, it continues with the lecture here for a few more minutes. We're fading out here because it's kind of a recap, and this is radio, so we think you got the full flavor of his presentation, and it was something else. Unbelievable. You're listening to a direct broadcast from the Laredo UFO Conference here on Inception Radio.